This is the Tripartisan Podcast with Ben Swain, James Henderson, and David Staley. Get ready for the latest football and basketball news and opinions on Duke, NC State, and Carolina with our insiders. Now, here's the Tripartisan Podcast.
The Tripartisans are back once again for WRELSportsFan.com. It's Ben. I'm here with James and Dave. As always, guys, big news today in the world of sports. Opening arguments in the FBI case, FBI versus college basketball, I guess, is what we're calling it, right? Do we care about this story at all? Like, what's going on here?
I don't. maybe I shouldn't be the one saying that, because I know states of us three, I think state's the one being mentioned. But in all seriousness, I think what's happening is everybody's finding out what we all who covered basketball recruiting knew what was going on. And so I'm not really shocked by it. I'm just kind of ready to see what's going to happen with it and how many schools are involved, because truth be told, if they really hit everybody for this, like they're supposed, like they could, it's going to be everybody. So, it's not really that big of a story to me, but, you know, I'm sure that'll probably change once I got to really start covering it here pretty soon.
Yeah, oh, Dave, man. Dave, what's the thought over in Chapel Hill about this?
I feel like if we rewound the clock five, 6, 7 years, that exact comment from James could have been heard from any Carolina fan.
It could be, and you're right, could be.
I think the biggest thing from the Carolina side of things is just that, I mean, at some level, you see Nasir Little's name tossed around as being one of the players who was potentially offered money, and you have to think, all right, well, if this guy turned down $150,000, I think it was, to go play somewhere else, is there any chance, that he took money to come here? And I feel like the answer is no. I mean, after 7 years of being investigated, you have to think that Carolina was not going to be involved in something like that. But also, after 7 years of being investigated, nothing will surprise me at this point. So,
hey, David, I think Nasir Little made a 40-year decision.
Okay. I hope he did. It's just hard to think about sometimes a 17 or 18 year old kid making that right decision.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, let's talk about that for a second. And I'm going to finish it up so that everyone hears this and they understand that I'm not like implicating UNC or saying anything bad about them. Because I've got a pretty clear stance on all of this that I'll throw out there in a second. But in order to believe that, you know, UNC is not involved in this in some way, is to say that Nasir Little, against his will, was being shopped to Arizona. And then when the story broke and he couldn't go there anymore, he finally got to go where he really wanted to go in the first place for free. And that's at UNC. That's like a big leap to make in terms of suspending your perception of reality. And the same thing's true with Duke. I mean, you don't get 2-3 lottery picks every year without being involved in this in some sort of way. And it's funny to me because it's almost better. And I want you guys to react to this. I think it's almost better for NC State from an NCAA point of view. And that's part of the whole crux of the story here is you've got an FBI investigation, but all of us think about it in terms of NCAA violations. We don't think about it in terms of, you know, federal crimes. But from the NCAA point of view, it's almost better for NC State if Duke and Carolina are involved, because the NCAA isn't going to do anything to jeopardize March Madness, and getting schools like Duke and Kentucky and North Carolina and Arizona and Kansas and all the schools that are being, you know, either directly or loosely mentioned out of March Madness will kill March Madness. And I just don't think anything can or will or should happen from an NCAA point of view. Does that hold any weight that it's almost better for NC State that, yeah, everybody's doing this?
Well, I mean, I thought when it first broke, there were, to various degrees, I mean, what was it, 40, 50, 60 schools linked in some way to all these different players in terms of benefits and different things like that. So, I mean, and I know it wasn't as widespread as Dennis Smith, but if I remember correctly, it wasn't like Wendell Carter mentioned to some degree, and I believe there was somebody at UNC. And again, I think it was something smaller, but my point's more, I think you're right. I think it's going to be so widespread that really I think the NCAA is going to just be able to throw their hands up and not do anything about it, because you can't. You know, just a little bit I saw on the case that started today, you know, and everybody's associating this with Adidas, but come to find out, you've seen Under Armour referenced already in terms of paying a player that ended up at Kentucky. You're seeing, Kentucky, I mean Kansas. You're seeing a Nike school. I think Oregon was being linked with paying a player. And so I think it's just going to be so widespread that really the NCAA can't do anything. They're just going to probably say, you know, this will take years to do. Let's implement some things now to fix it, and let's try and move forward.
Yeah, is there any concern about, like, what could potentially happen to these schools? Like, we haven't really done this before, and really the stuff that just went through with this college basketball commission, part of it was that it opened the door for the NCAA to use, you know, evidence or discussions from these federal trials in their investigations or in their infractions hearings. I don't know, like, what you can do. I mean, and obviously State, it's not that big of a deal, because if Dennis Smith Jr. is the one that's being implicated, which, again, I said it on Twitter today, I'll say it again right now, $40,000 for Dennis Smith Jr. is a federal crime. Like, that guy is worth so much more than $40,000. So if that's all that he was getting, then you know, it's probably good that these numbers are getting out there. But NC State missed the postseason that year. So they get a great player. They have, you know, a really fun season to watch. There's nothing to lose from a retroactive, let's go back and strip results point of view. There's no concern there. Obviously, Duke and Carolina have a little bit more to lose in that department. Dave, is there any concern there about any of, you know, UNT's involvement with, you know, potentially losing ACC championship or a national championship or whatever stupid thing the NCAA decides to end up doing if these schools are ultimately implicated?
I mean, I guess in as much as, like, there's a risk for Duke, right, to lose a national championship, there's a risk for Carolina. Just because, I mean, at this point, you don't know what's going to come out. I would say, do I think any school is going to lose a national championship? Probably not. But at the same time, do I think there's a chance that something could come out about Duke in 15 or Carolina in 17 that puts something at risk? Yeah, sure. I don't know. Like, I'm with you. I mean, at some level, if enough stuff comes out that, you know, every school was doing something, which I think is ultimately going to be the finding if they keep digging and digging and digging. You know, you just can't go back and say, all right, well, we're just going to blow up the last 20 years of college basketball and none of this ever happened. I mean, it's going to become the steroid era for baseball, right? Like, everybody will just have an asterisk beside their titles, but you'll still acknowledge the fact that it happened. I mean, Mark McGwire hit 70 home runs in whatever year that was, and everybody still knows that it occurred. And so I think it would be the same thing, but I don't know. I'm not sure how much they'll find. I guess my biggest question in all this, to go slightly the opposite direction of serious, is, I mean, if you look at the schools that are a part of the trial that started today, Tuesday, as we record this, you got Kansas, Louisville, Miami, and NC State. Is the ACC the only crap conference that has three schools stuck in an Adidas contract?
That's a good point. That's a very good point. I want to throw out something to you guys, and maybe we can use our supreme power as tripartisans in doing this. when a team is stripped of a national championship, like the conversation with Louisville in, was it 13? Is that when they won?
Yeah, I think
12 or
yep.
whatever.
Yep.
So when Louisville won their championship and the conversation about stripping their banner, really the only people that matters to is Kentucky fans, right? And so, like, let's the three of us, if we all agree in our hearts that this whole thing is dumb and these guys deserve, you know, as much compensation as they can get their hands on while they're in college. If any of these schools end up getting vacated wins or any kind of like, you know, no real set, like a real sanction is we're going to pull two scholarships or, you know, a postseason ban or something along those lines. Again, I don't think the NCAA is going to go that route. They're going to do something toothless like, hey, we're going to strip these wins from you. Let's just stack hands and agree that we're not going to care about that. Like, Dave, if UNC loses the national championship, I will still fully recognize that UNC won the national championship that year.
On Twitter, in addition to on this podcast, right?
Yes. I'll when we hang up on this podcast, I will tweet it out right now and put a call to action to all Duke fans that there will be no mention at all. Like we will 100% recognize that UNC has won those national championships, and we'll just agree that this whole thing is dumb because these guys, you know, again, like I said with Dennis Smith Jr., if all he's doing is getting $40,000, that's a bargain. Like that's an absolute steal. And what was the number with Nasir Little in Arizona? 150,000. Like even that is a steal. So this whole thing is dumb for me, at least.
I'm on board. I feel like James has the most to lose in all this because he's going to agree to not take away a title, but he's not going to get to not have a title taken away.
Yeah. You guys going to, can I keep my 9 wins?
Okay. We will allow you to keep your 9 wins as well. I think that it's only fair, really.
The best part is the most memorable thing Dennis Smith Jr. did at State didn't count anyway, because it was after the buzzer, but it was that was the awesome.
Duncan Cameron.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, look, you know, State's 9 wins are safe on tripartisan. But really, I'm kind of with you both. I mean, I think there's nothing worse in terms of punishment than stripping wins. I mean, I mean worse from a comical sense. You know, I don't think it accomplishes anything. I don't even know why you do it. And you're right, Ben. I think that would be the route they'd probably go, thinking they are accomplishing something. But yeah, I mean, look, if they go back and try to take something away for UNC or Duke in terms of wins like that, I'm with you guys. I mean, let's just continue to honor it and I guess just skip whatever the NCAA is saying on this.
All right. So your elected officials from Duke, NC State, and North Carolina have spoken on this, that's the law now, right? Is that right? It's the law?
I'm pretty sure that's how it works, yeah.
There okay. you go.
I didn't pay much attention in civics class, but I'm going to assume that is accurate. Let's talk some other big news today coming out in the football world, James. NC State has got a contingency plan if they don't make the ACC championship game that they're going to play East Carolina on December 1st. Shockingly at noon. Why would that game be played?
Well, I think NC State always was planning on playing 12 games this year. Whether that's ECU, whether that's somehow they find their way into the championship game on that date, that was their goal. And when the game was postponed with West Virginia, they started right away trying to find an opponent. And obviously, I mean, I think your pickings are kind of slim. You're kind of probably having to comb over the opponents that suffered the same issue you had to deal with during the hurricane. And I mean, so there weren't a lot of teams to choose from. And I guess they settled with ECU. Obviously, ECU is probably looking for another check. I mean, I think the number I saw being tossed around was $300,000 to play that game. For NC State, it's another gate. Another home game, which is something they were losing with the West Virginia game. So it's another source of revenue, which I assume obviously played a big role in the decision as well.
But I mean, I think if you're NC State, you hope you don't play that game because you're playing, you know, in Charlotte or against Miami, Virginia Tech, or Duke, whoever is coming over from the Coastal.
Or Carolina, they're still got a chance.
Or Carolina, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, or Carolina.
Yeah, I was gonna say that.
Yeah, I think it's definitely, you nailed it with the money grab. And I did see something about, you know, how much, like, this was actually in reference to Chapel Hill, how much the town of Chapel Hill makes on a home football weekend. I'm sure that number is even higher for Raleigh. So that makes sense to me. Just from a competitive point of view, though, that's my question.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I'd never play ECU, to be honest with you. Because it's not it's one of those, you know, I think lose situations for NC State. Just because, I mean, you're supposed to win that game, and you know, when you don't, you have to hear about it. When you do, you never hear about it. So I don't really see the point in it. But again, I think it's a money situation. I think it lined up for both teams. Obviously, NC State hasn't had a lot of success against East Carolina in recent years. Now, they haven't played them at home in a few years, so they're going to get that opportunity. The other thing I thought was interesting was, I believe they opened the year in 2019 with ECU. So it's kind of like one of those deals where if you have – I assume at this point it seems like NC State's going to have a bowl, so it's not going to truly be back-to-back games, but you are going to play them two and three opportunities. So – yeah, I think it was kind of interesting they chose to go that route with East Carolina because I do think from a competitive standpoint, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me to play it. But I think finance, you know how it works, man. Finance rules these things. And I think State was wanting to guarantee themselves a 12th game.
I'm here to tell you it's definitely a lose-lose scenario.
Right. Hey, I mean, State experienced that, you know, 2 or 3 years ago in Greenville. So I'm right there with you.
We're at three times in a row.
Oh,
from wrong with the bowl selection process has removed a lot of the standings based criteria, right? Like you've got the different tiers of bowls, and they can pick who they want. They can. There's none of this. If this team has two more wins than another team, you can't pick them over that team anymore. I believe, is that the case?
I think so, but I'm not certain on it. I actually thought the two game rule stayed in play. I thought it was anything under that, but I could be wrong.
Okay.
I think I got to look that up. I'm not certain.
Yeah, I'll research that as well. Okay. I was hoping that you would know off the top of your head since you know a lot of stuff. We'll look that up. I was just thinking from a competitive point of view, even a win is not going to help their bowl resume in terms of being an attractive team to pick. I think they're already plenty attractive for a bowl to pick them over, you know, a Duke or a Wake Forest or, you know, one of those other schools that they would be competing for that definitely don't have as big of a fan base. But if that does matter, then maybe that's another reason that they're playing that game to get a ninth or potential 10th win or, maybe even better. You know, I guess if it's better than that, they probably won't be playing that game anyway.
Well, and I think the question for, you know, for this podcast is, does UNC go that route? Because, you know, I think they'd have the opportunity as well. And the other option would be if you're on that 5, 6, 7 win kind of line where you need a win to go to a bowl game. You know, I remember, I think we talked about this previously. I think FSU scheduled that game last year to kind of keep their bowl streak alive. So, you know, that's another reason to play that game is maybe you're right there kind of needing a win for bowl eligibility and you need a 12th opportunity. So I don't know if State was looking at it from that point. You never know how the season plays out. I mean, I think you feel right now they're comfortably likely going to make a bowl, but I think that would be the other option would be, you know, if you're right around 5, 6 wins, I mean, do you need one to get into a bowl game?
I think for Carolina, the chances of being in that situation at this point are slim. And I think State actually had a much easier opportunity to schedule a game because, you know, if you think about the schools that were impacted by the hurricane, you've got ECU, you've got Virginia Tech. Well, I mean, Carolina already had ECU on the schedule, so that's out as a makeup game. Right. VT is in the Coastal Division, so that's out. Really, I mean, without looking at all the other teams in the country that only played 11 games this year, I mean, the one that comes to mind is App. I have a hard time thinking that we're going to schedule a game against App in a season where we lost to ECU already. I mean, I don't think you want to have a year where you lose, where you could potentially lose to App State, ECU, NC State, and Duke all in one season. That does not sound appealing to me. So
could you schedule Pitt again?
If we could schedule Pitt 8 more times, that would be awesome.
Just play a. I actually wondered if NC State would try to schedule UNC a second time.
I mean, I guess the other option is, I mean, I don't know what UCF's end of season schedule is like, but I mean, if they're, you know, not in line to play in their, you know, conference championship game, would it be possible for them to do a similar thing to what State and ECU did of, hey, a contingent on not being in a championship game, we could play on X date. But even then, I mean, I don't, like, after seeing what UCF just did this weekend to Pitt, right? I'm not sure that's something Carolina wants to get themselves into either at this point in the season.
What if UNC did this as a fundraiser where they just open bids for any team that's stuck on 5 wins and just, and just be like, look, guys, we got an open date and we're going to the highest bidder and just try to earn some money that can then be rolled into paying recruits.
The buyout fund. It's the start of the buyout fund.
it goes right into the Fire Larry Fedora fund.
That's not the worst idea you've ever had.
we'll make sure that one gets to Bubba Cunningham and make that one work. Question for you, Dave, if UNC gets that 12th game rescheduled, or even the next game that they play. They're on a bye this weekend, I believe. Is that right?
That's right.
And then it's Miami?
Virginia Tech.
No, they just played. Miami.
We just got destroyed by Miami. We don't want to do that again.
Virginia Tech, 7 p.m., I believe, next weekend. UNC gets to play at night just to troll State. Who's going to be UNC's quarterback in that game?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? I think at some level, I think you have to give Surratt one more chance. You know, he goes in to play against Miami. So, I mean, he goes up against a strong defense in his first game back after the suspension. So, I mean, he hadn't played in, you know, since last season. Admittedly, I don't really care who he was playing. He didn't look that good. But I think after that, I mean, if you look at the schedule, we've got 7 games left, right? We've already used Fortin in one game. So that leaves him with 3 more games left that he could play in without burning his red shirt. Then, I mean, if you want to keep going down and the message boards definitely do. I mean, the fans are clamoring for some other solution. And so, I mean, if you want to keep going down the line, you've also got Reuter in there, who would be another option to then play 4 games. So you could essentially play each one of them their full 4-game allotment. I mean, and see how it turns out and figure out, all right, who should be the quarterback next year. I think I really think you have to give Surratt one more game, right? I mean, he's only played in one game this year. But it just doesn't look like either him or Nathan Elliott are the answer. And my fear is that at some level that one of the two of them is going to transfer right after this season, with neither one of them kind of emerging as the starter and doesn't seem in line to be the starter next year. Like, is it possible that you lose one of them? And if so, you can't go into next season the same way that you come into 2018 with, well, is it Elliott or Surratt? You can't go into 19 with a question of, is it Fortin or Reuter, right? I mean, you have to have a quarterback going into the season, which I feel like it's something Carolina fans have said for the last 7 years since Fedora got here. I mean, it just seems like every year there's some sort of quarterback controversy. But I mean, I think at this point in the season at 1-3, you just have to start thinking, all right, let's figure out who the freshmen are. You know, we know that they're highly touted, but could one of them emerge to be promising this season? The flip side of that is, you know, what if you toss somebody out there who's not ready and you kill their confidence? It almost kind of seems like that's what happened to Surratt last season. So do you run the risk of doing that again if you throw somebody out there who's not ready? And now they could have been a possibility next year, but instead, you know, next year winds up being a dud too. So who's going to be the quarterback? I got no idea. And you're not going to get the answer from Fedora either. So I don't know.
Do you think the starting quarterback next Saturday against Virginia Tech is going to be the 2019 quarterback? Do you think that's, like, breaking down what you just said, is that the most important decision?
I think by the end of this season, we have to know who the 2019 quarterback is. I don't necessarily think that whoever starts next weekend is going to be that person, but I think the next 7 games should be dedicated to figuring out who that person is, if that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. It absolutely makes perfect sense. And I think Duke is in a similar situation with Quentin Harris, because I think if, you know, Daniel Jones obviously miraculously came back from shoulder surgery, and I have no idea how that's even possible, but he did. Quentin Harris isn't going to start the rest of the year unless Jones gets hurt again. So you got to imagine that he's going to transfer at the end of the season. And the talk is that Daniel Jones is done with his college career after this year. If he has that opportunity, I think he will. But that's kind of the talk there. And then they've got, you know, Gunnar Holmberg, who should be the guy next season. But you also run the risk of losing a pretty okay quarterback with Quentin Harris. It's just it's a really tough decision. And it goes back to, James, you're the recruiting guy. The old adage is sign a quarterback every class. Is that becoming more of a headache than a blessing at this point for a lot of schools?
I think it's so difficult. It's funny because, you know, I was looking at just recruiting, and NC State, they actually landed a couple weeks back Bailey Hockman, who transferred from Florida State, I think 3 days before the season started, to junior college. And he's going to be in junior college for a semester and then be at NC State in January and be eligible. And, you know, these new transfer rules and different types of, like, loopholes you've got, you can do things like that where you can literally – you know, not win a quarterback battle as a redshirt freshman, transfer, and you're eligible for the next battle somewhere else in 4 or 5 months. And it leaves Florida State with two scholarship quarterbacks on their roster. It's just mind-boggling to me. You can't keep three scholarship quarterbacks happy. But and I think David mentioned it earlier with Carolina. You just know it's inevitable that someone's going to transfer out of their situation, because they've got, five scholarship quarterbacks on the roster. So someone's not going to be happy. And then the way it pertains to, I think, all three of these schools is Sam Howell. I mean, I know you guys don't follow recruiting a lot, but he's a 4 or 5-star kid out of the Charlotte area, 2019 quarterback, who has been committed to Florida State. And apparently he's not happy with the situation in Florida State. He's looking at North Carolina. I think he's even looking at Duke. I think he's looking at West Virginia. He's a guy who could potentially end up at Duke or UNC and really kind of muddy things even more. And I think you're right. I think in this era of college football, where, you know, guys at quarterback, you excel and you keep the job for the most part. I mean, it's hard to keep everybody on your roster happy. And so I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with Howell, because he's a guy who could potentially change around a lot of these programs if he's as legitimate as people say he is.
So I know players have to do what's best for them, and I get that, and I get the looking out for yourself, and I'm sure if I was in that situation, I would have similar, you know, motivations for myself. But what is a school supposed to do? I mean, just like look at Kelly Bryant. Kelly Bryant loses a starting job. He literally could have waited 4 more days and been the starter again. So, like, I can't fault the guy, but how does a school keep a backup quarterback in this day and time?
I think it's going to it often has to deal with where you're at from an experience standpoint. I think Ben mentioned that. Ben, is Quentin Harris, is he a junior? So he can transfer and play somewhere next year. And that's kind of what State had with Jalen McClendon. I mean, I think it's really hard to keep that upperclassman. But I guess your hope is you can pitch to these younger guys, stay, bide your time. Like, for instance, with Bailey Hockman at FSU, I think his issue was, from what I've gathered, he didn't feel like he got a fair shake at that quarterback battle. You know, 2 years ago, Francois was the quarterback. Last year, James Blackman, he was competing against both of those. I think everybody assumed one of those two guys would be the guy, so he didn't think he had a fair shot. Once it was announced that it was Francois, he left. But, yeah, I mean, the Kelly Bryant thing is mind-boggling to me, because how you can say you didn't get a fair shot when you started the first 4 games, that's crazy. I mean, you were the starter, and you got outplayed, and it is what it is. That one really surprised me. I mean, you look at what Jalen Hurts is doing at Alabama. He actually played in his 5th game this weekend, so he can't transfer, or he can't redshirt and get that year back. And he's just going to be a backup now. And, I mean, he's got a lot better resume than Kelly Bryant does. So, yeah, the Bryant thing blew my mind when I saw he was transferring, because he was no longer starting. And you see where Clemson's at right now.
I'm glad you brought up Jalen Hurts, because in my opinion, and I agree with you that he's got a better track record or better resume than Kelly Bryant does. He's almost doing himself a favor by not playing football this year, because every time you go out on the field, it's a chance to get hurt. And he's got his draft status, right? Like, he's going to get drafted. He's going to get a chance to play in the NFL, and he doesn't have to play college football this year. And it's like, it's awesome for him, right? I mean, he gets to be on the best team in the country, probably win another national championship, get in spot duty, because Alabama's killing everybody they're playing, and doesn't have to shoulder the load of being an everyday quarterback and risking himself getting injured. But I think Kelly Bryant has to be on the field to, show what he can do for NFL scouts. I don't know. I just think Jalen Hurts got the best job in the country right now.
Well, he does, because not only do you get all the perks that you mentioned, you also don't have the risk of being exposed. You know, I mean, we see that on the basketball side, where these guys go to college, and sometimes they get exposed when they go to college, and that's why some want the one and done rule. Whereas I think with the Hurts situation, you're right. He's got a resume. He's now going to be likely coming into games only when Alabama's up probably 40 on teams, which is every weekend now. But, hey, I think it sets him up in a position where he's really going to look, come out, like you said, looking really good and getting that chance in the next level. Whereas I think prior to them making that move, there were some people that were starting to question him as a quote-unquote quarterback. I mean, you look at some of his big games. I mean, he hasn't really put up huge numbers, but I think – them making the move when they did, it's allowed him to kind of keep his resume where it's at.
Yeah, it's just the whole conversation's super interesting to me, and it just goes back to what I started the question with, of the adage of you sign a quarterback every year. It just seems to be such a headache for these schools, because you got to think about how do I keep this guy happy so that he doesn't leave and put me in a bind next year. And you end up seeing people losing eligibility because of it. You end up seeing, a lot of infighting. I think there have been some comments in the Clemson camp this week. Hunter Renfro said something today that seemed like he was throwing some shade at Kelly Bryant. I think a lot of Clemson fans will say he wasn't, but it certainly read that way. And I don't know that it's worth it. It's almost better to, say, hey, this is going to be my quarterback for 2 or 3 seasons. I'm going to recruit this other guy as a backup. But maybe that's just setting yourself up for failure as well. Did I lose you guys?
No, we're still here.
Okay. Maybe we'll edit that. We'll edit that part out. We can end on that note. We've reached our limit of talking football between Duke State and Carolina. I'll throw out a stat for you guys that I wrote about for WRL this week, and I want to hear about what you guys are writing about. Since 1930, 29 times combined between the three schools has a school won more than 8 games in a season, and that's about 11% of the time a team reaches that threshold. And so it's kind of funny. It came to mind looking at Duke, but also looking at NC State this year, where you're like, man, if they only win 9 games, it's kind of a letdown at this point. But it's only happened 29 times since 1930. That's really depressing when you think about it.
Oh, I agree. It's, you know, I mean, you're right. I think you probably were looking kind of at the schedule like I was, and you're sitting here looking at NC State schedule now, and you're like, man, 9 wins. I mean, it's hard finding 3 teams they should lose to, if that makes sense. But they're in that position. But, yeah, I mean, even 9 wins, I mean, that's an improvement for them over last year when they were, you know, held as – I mean, they received a lot of pub, you know, based on how last year was. But there's just not a lot of tradition. I mean, there's really not. And I tell people that, you know, on our boards when people are sitting here saying, look at the whiteout at Penn State, or look at the crowd at Ohio State. And, you know, obviously NC State's got a good crowd, but you're not at that level. And I think you get to that level from years of success and the tradition that some of those schools have had.
Dave, what are you writing about this week?
Well, so do you have a list of all the times that's happened? I mean, to the best of my memory, I'm thinking back. I mean, Carolina won 11 games in 2015. I don't know that they've won 9 games in a season other than that year since Mac Brown was here. Is that maybe you can't confirm, but I don't think they have.
Yeah,
they've got a lot of 8 wins, but I can't think of a 9 win season since then.
Carolina actually had the best track record of the three schools when it came to reaching that mark, and they'd done it multiple times in each decade. So I guess when Mac Brown was there, did Butch ever win 9 games? Was he responsible for a 9-win season?
I think he only won 8.
Okay. But it had been, you know, the 70s, there were a couple seasons. The 80s, there were a couple seasons. 90s, there were a couple seasons. And then I think there were 2 since 2000. But I could be – it could have just been that one time, but I think it was twice. But UNC actually had the most consistent track record of that time. Duke had 4 back in like the 1940s, and then 2 since David Cutcliffe got here, and that was it. So they went, you know, 30, 40 years without ever getting to that point. And then State came in the middle of that. But it's not good. Across the board, it's not good.
It's not. I agree.
What's going on in UNC land this week?
So this week I'm giving – you'll see in my column, but I'm giving positivity one more chance before I completely abandon that approach and go back to being
before positivity transfers.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, I took some negative stats and I turned them into positive thoughts, in the column this week. So that'll post Wednesday morning.
James, what about you?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, you know, digging into this noon game stuff that everybody's been getting on, but really more looking at it from the broad perspective that we kind of talked about, I think, on an earlier podcast on how, I think, Ben, we talked about this on the one you couldn't make, me and David did, about how it's just hard, I think, across college football from an attendance standpoint, you know, to constantly have your attendance where you want it outside of some of these, you know, these few programs.
Right.
And maybe dig into why, you know, like for instance, I just think it, you know, you look at a situation like Penn State, there's not a ton there going on, you know, to be honest with you. But just different reasons like that as to why it may be going on and why, you know, I think attendance, it's not a noon thing. I think attendance is an every game thing, and for programs like NC State too.
Yeah, there's not much you can do. We know there's not much you can do about the start time, but it's attendance is an issue everywhere, and there's just too much stuff going on. I know me personally. We talk about this every week. I got a chance to watch the game on my phone, or I watched it in a restaurant with the sound off. You know, stuff like that. You've got things that go on. And we're people who are glued to this stuff. And so if you're a casual fan, yeah, you just got a lot of stuff going on that's going to take you away from it, unless you're somewhere like a Penn State where Saturdays revolve around that. And that is all anybody does ever. And I'm looking forward to reading that. Dave, I'll give you one last positive thought about your Tar Heels. I haven't laughed harder, and I feel bad about laughing, but I haven't laughed harder in a long time than I did during the 10 seconds that Chaz Surratt looked at the receiver on the last interception. I literally had time to say, dude, do not throw that ball before he threw it. It was just one of those things where, like, you felt bad to a certain point, and then it just reached into the comic point. And trust me, man, I sat through at least three seasons where Duke did not win a game. So I laughed many times during those as well. But that last interception drew an audible cackle from me. I'll fully admit that.
At some level, that's all you can do, right?
Well, we guarantee you that Duke and Carolina will not lose this week. NC State's got a big game against Boston College. We will be back next week to talk about that and maybe some more of this FBI stuff. And I don't know who else, maybe some recruiting. We'll talk about it. But we promise that it will be good. That's our guarantee to you. So,
gosh, I really like how Duke goes 4-0, and we talk a lot about football. And a lot about Duke football.
And then they lose.
Duke loses to Virginia Tech, and suddenly
it's over with. We're not talking football anymore.
Maybe we'll get I'm fine with that. I'm perfectly fine with that.
We'll break down some Olympic sports next week.
Women's soccer, let's do it.
I'm all for it. Well, on behalf of James and Dave, I am Ben. We are the Tripartisans, and we will see you next week.
You've been listening to the Tripartisan Podcast with Ben Swain, James Henderson, and David Staley. We hope you enjoy this show every week during the ACC football and basketball season. Our three insiders will have another installment next week on all the football and basketball happenings with Duke, NC State, and Carolina. Don't forget you can download and listen to this podcast at WRALSportsFan.com, the WRAL Sports Fan app, or subscribe to it in iTunes and Google Play stores.